Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Because newspaper headlines seem to be overly dominated by the pandemic, so many important stories that we would have focused on before are forgotten about. And one of those is the issue of homelessness. Earlier on in the week, I chatted to Professor Patricia Casey, where she was raising this issue and how we might better deal with it. And she started off just explaining the numbers of people currently experiencing homelessness in Ireland.
Well, the last figures that are available were published in November 2019, and there were 139 people sleeping rough. Now, the piece that I wrote and that you referred to as dealing specifically with that group, there are many more who are homeless, but who may be living in hostels semi-long-term. They may be staying with family or friends, even though they don't have a definitive home there. So the rough sleepers in November 2019 were about 139, and that's as much as we have. And people, many of these people sleep rough all the time. They don't have the organisation in their own heads to contact the homeless hostels to get beds. There was a documentary on television on RTE about it a few weeks ago called RTE Investigates, and they found that some people were being turned away from beds in hostels when they rang the Dublin ones because they were homeless in Carlow or Kildare or Kilkenny. So the homeless hostels seem to be only catering for the local service, not providing a service for people within potential reach of Dublin.
And what about the cost of some of these, for example, emergency beds, and kind of comparing that to maybe how that money could be spent in a better way, Patricia?
Well, the cost of an emergency bed, it's about 35,000 to 40,000 per person per year. So that's an awful lot of money. The state in 2016 put 10 million overall into emergency beds. But 3 years later, that had doubled to 22 million. So it begs the question, what is happening to the money? Where is it going? Why have the costs spiralled? And nobody knows the answer to these questions. The government, I think, needs to be really focused on this issue and need to have somebody charged specifically with looking at all of these figures and trying to square the circle, because it's not making any sense. There would be an increase in 12 million in 3 years, but with no very little change in the number of rough sleepers.
And one of the things, Patricia, that you mentioned in your piece is those who'd actually been refused a bed since the start of the pandemic. What are the root causes of this?
Well, one of the causes that I mentioned earlier is that people were ringing from other counties. For example, a man was interviewed who was homeless in Naas, and this was now on the TV programme 2 weeks ago, the RTE Investigates programme, and he was turned away because he was homeless in Naas, not in Dublin. I mean, it is possible that some of the, that these beds are full, and certainly during the pandemic, and during the cold weather, it's likely that that they may be full. There just may not be any. It may be that, you know, the callers who were turned away were hostile and aggressive and threatening. We just don't know. And again, this whole area has more questions than answers.
Yeah, and that's the frustrating thing, you know, when you're looking at it from the outside, even just the sheer kind of cost and wondering, well, how would that money be perhaps better spent? But it's not just about spending money, it's about helping people who find themselves in homelessness for lots of different reasons.
And the interesting thing is that Finland, which is about the same size as Ireland and it's the same population much, and Helsinki, which is approximately the same size as Dublin, they have almost zero rough sleepers, and they have a model called Housing First, which it's based on a very strong philosophy that everybody has a right to a place to live, to a place they call home. It may be a bedsit, it may be a house, it may be a flat, but that everybody has that right. And of course in Ireland, a government a few years ago in their wisdom got rid of bedsits, and that threw a lot more people onto the street than would otherwise have been the case. And I think what drove the end to bedsits was the fact that some of them were of a very poor quality, the cost of them was quite high, and so it was felt to be unjust. On the other hand, perhaps there should be a model that has oversight of these kinds of bedsits to ensure quality and to ensure that landlords aren't coining, taking advantage of, you know, the homeless people. So in Finland, they've got this model called Housing First. And now it has to be said that in Ireland, some of the charitable housing organisations like the Peter McVerry Trust and Focus Ireland use this model. And so they try to give everybody a home, a place they call home, you know, in the long term, so that they can stay in their hostels in the long term.
And what's the situation here, Patricia? Is somebody, in terms of, is it flipped on its head compared to Finland, where somebody has to be, for example, if they have an issue with addiction, that they have to handle that first before they're given a house, or how does it work?
Well, the problem in Ireland is that in Finland, people will get a house, will get housed even if they have a mental health problem or an addiction problem. They're first of all given a house because that's a fundamental right, they believe, and that will be the springboard from which they can deal with all of the other problems that have befallen them. In Ireland, it's the reverse. So if somebody is homeless and drug addict, they will not be given a home. They will not be given a place to stay. They may, if they're lucky, get an emergency bed, but they will not be given a more permanent place to stay. And I would have thought that needs to be changed. I believe that needs to be changed. And then adequate facilities for the for people with, particularly with addiction, because the addiction services are quite limited in this country.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
You know, relationships are hard enough at the best of times, but now that we have the added pressure of living through a global pandemic, how can we try to protect our relationships? Well, earlier on in the week, I spoke to Brian Harmon, who's involved with Cana Ireland, who do a lot of weeks away for supporting couples and their families. Now, of course, that can't happen at the moment, so they've decided to put together an online video series to try and help couples during this time. But Brian started off before he talked about the video series, just explaining what a typical Cana week looks like.
Cana week, Wendy, first of all, it's a week for couples who just want more. My wife and I, Lisa, we were very blessed when we were married. Our children arrived on the scene very quickly, thank God. But within a few years of us being married, I was an expert in changing nappies and midnight feeds and this sort of thing. And I remember as time was going on, I wanted more. Like, we were happily married, but I just remember thinking, praying one night to the Lord, going, God, is this it? I want more. I had
stuck in a rut, stuck in a routine.
I didn't want just good. I wanted brilliant. We came to Cana, and Cana allowed us to reconnect. We had a week. It was in 2014. It's changed our lives. It's changed our marriage, and it's changed my relationship with the Lord and my wife as well, and each other. But the typical Cana week, the way we promote it is, we look after the kids while you're looking after your marriage. So the children will be in their own ministry. Now, it's not just for people with young families. Cana is for people, maybe empty nesters. The children have just left. Maybe couples on the verge of retirement. Goodness me, we're about to be looking at each other every day of the week. And it's also for those loved up newlyweds, but even for people who may not be married yet. They could be cohabiting, but they're heading towards the sacrament of marriage. We are open to all Christian faith. We are a Catholic organisation, but we are open to all Christian faith, including those who may be on the verge of falling away from the faith. Part of our mission as well is to be evangelical.
And reach out to everyone, Brian. I have to say, I'd say there's lots of people like me listening with small kids going, oh gosh, that would be great. The kids are minded, we're getting time together. That can't happen this year. And also that feeling, as I said in the introduction, that
it's the year that you need it most, because things are very difficult in lots of different ways, whether it's financial pressures because someone's lost a job, homeschooling, juggling all that, or having people who've actually gotten sick during this pandemic. So tell us a little bit about, you're trying to think outside the box and provide some support for families and for couples. Tell us about this online initiative, Brian.
Okay, so like many organisations, in order to reach out to people, we have come up with a new initiative. It's called CAMA at Home. Now, the details for it are available on the CAMA Ireland Facebook page. So get on to CAMA Ireland Facebook page. You see the links there for the YouTube channels. Tonight at 8 o'clock, we are going live with a new programme. And it's very much ordinary married people in CAMA. It's for the English-speaking world, because our parent organisation is a French organisation. So it's CAMA Ireland, CAMA UK, CAMA Canada and CAMA US have got together every fortnight over the next number of weeks. We're doing a snippet, a taste of CAMA. The way we advertise it, Wendy, is that Jesus performed the first miracle, his first miracle at CAMA, at a wedding feast at CAMA. He turned the ordinary water into a very special wine. He turned the ordinary into the extraordinary. CAMA at Home is a taste of that wine. It allows people to switch off, forget about homeschooling, forget about working at home, forget about all of these things that have been forcing us at the moment. It's just an opportunity to catch up with your couple.
Yeah, and just connect to one another. So what can we expect then from this evening session? Do we need to have pen and paper ready or a glass of wine? Which should we have, Brian?
I would say both, okay? It's fine. I would maybe ease off in the wine and toward the end of the session. But it's going to be a talk, and the talks will be on various rooms in the house as the weeks go on. So it's literally CAMA at home, in your own home environment. So tonight's talk is in the home overall. There'll be other weeks, the talk will be on the living room. Talk maybe on where we sleep, in the bedroom. The talk, there's actually one, Wendy, on CAMA in the bathroom. So that's going to be an interesting one. But also CAMA in the home.
Where most mums and some dads are never left alone if they have small children.
Yeah, very good. But we're just trying to give people that pause. It's a small taste of what CAMA offers. And it's just to be able to reach out to couples at the moment and just to look at each other, turn off the TV, turn off the radio, and let the kids watch a movie later tonight, from, you know, or put them in bed early. And those, you know, who just need just to reconnect, there'll be a few seeds planted. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, let CAMA plant some seeds and we'll let the Lord do the rest of the work.
And Brian, do people have to watch it live or how is it going to work?
Okay, so tonight it's going live. Now, all of these sessions are pre-recorded. CAMA Ireland, we're actually working our recording at the moment. That's going to be up probably in about 3 sessions' time. We have a fantastic couple, Tony and Victoria, doing that for us. And the YouTube clips will be up there. They'll go on each week for the next 2 weeks. The new one will be added on at that time, Wendy. But they're going to remain there. So we will be promoting CAMA at Home, please God, for years to come. And that program will be up there. So we're asking people to subscribe. We want to get the hits high on it. But it will be up there. We're going to let it run. And we will build on this initiative. So maybe in time to come, there might be other videos and so on put up on it. But tonight, 8 o'clock, it's already a little slot that's available there on YouTube. And it'll be filled tonight. But it will remain there for, please God, months and years to come.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Journalist Melanie McDonough recently wrote an opinion piece about the Irish Times, sharing the experience her father had because he was an illegitimate child during the time of the mother and baby homes. One of the things that she expressed was concern around the negative narrative around adoption. Earlier on in the week, she spoke to me a little bit about this, but she started off just by telling me a little bit more about her father's story.
He was illegitimate. He was born to the daughter of the postmaster in Ballyconoo, who was a Protestant. And being illegitimate, his aunt took him to a Protestant institution, which, as a child, we thought was the Countess of Wicklow Hospital. But I'm wondering, looking at the mother and baby report, whether it might have been the Countess of Bessborough Institution, one of the ones that was mentioned in the report. His aunt took him to the Protestant institution to try and get them to take him, because obviously there was shame and stigma. attached to have your bastard child at the time, and they wouldn't take him. They were full or no space or not the right time.
So he was turned away even from there?
He was turned away, and then my aunt, my great-aunt rather, brought him back to Ballyconnell via Arklow. And in Arklow, she dropped in at a Protestant draper's known as Sam Ford's in the main street, and she put her basket on the table with the baby, and as my mother told it, said, I don't know what to do with this baby. And behind the counter, there was a shop assistant who was Catholic, and she said, well, my sister doesn't have any children. She'll take him. So she ran off to get my grandmother. My grandmother came back, and as my mother said, she took the baby under a cardigan and went back home with it, and then had him baptised and raised him as her own. His aunt returned to Ballyconnell, and subsequently the postmaster used to send my grandmother sheets of stamps by way of child maintenance. Now, my father did try subsequently to get in touch with his birth mother, but the whole experience seemed to have been traumatic for her. For one thing, her family seemed to have thought that the man she subsequently married, who was a Catholic guard, was the child's father. My father wrote to her about this, and she wrote back to say, my husband was not your father. There was some story about him being a Protestant solicitor at the time, and who knows what the circumstances were. The point about the story wasn't that it was unique by any means. It was that the shame and the stigma around illegitimacy, presumably in respect of a young girl, I imagine she wasn't much more than 20-odd, it was such that a Protestant family was quite as anxious as a Catholic one to get rid of the child and to leave him somewhere where he'd be cared for by others rather than brought up amongst themselves.
And even that image, Melanie, that you described, you know, your grandmother having to hide the child under her cardigan.
Oh, no, that was just, she wasn't hiding him, she was just trying to keep him warm.
Okay.
I didn't quite mean to suggest that she was trying to suffocate him, but she brought him home and he had a grand life.
And how was she treated? Do you know much about your grandmother that she took care of your father? What was the attitude towards her then?
Well, everybody was delighted for her that she had this lovely baby. She also had another child, that is to say my aunt, who was left with her, I think, for safekeeping by a travelling theatre troupe from Northern Ireland. And they left her with my aunt, Yoli, and she looked after her. And indeed, when the mother came back, there was no trace of the family because my grandmother wanted to keep the little girl, and she'd grown very fond of her. The fact was that the two of them grew up very happily together. Fortuitously, they both looked very similar, and they had a very similar disposition. And although my grandparents were very poor, my grandfather was a sailor and jumped ship in New York, and he travelled the whole world as a sailor. He never had much money, and income was very irregular. But my father had a very happy life, as indeed did my aunt. And so the story, in a way, ended well. I don't know about my natural grandmother. When my father tried to get in touch, it was plainly a source of pain for her. She wrote back in that letter where she said that her husband wasn't my father's father. And she said, I seem to have been born to bring pain to everybody around me. And after that, my father said that he wasn't going to have anybody approach her because he didn't want the poor woman tormented anymore. So my father felt keenly that her privacy should be respected and that she shouldn't be pursued any longer. But I believe subsequently she moved to Thomastown under the name of Liddy. The whole thing was, I think, illustrative of the fact that illegitimacy happened, the Protestants as well as Catholics, and no surprises there, but also that the reaction of Protestants was identical to that of Catholics. That is to say, it was broader social norms rather than squarely religious ones or denominational ones that was important. And also, the gist of some of the reaction to the mother and baby report was that adoption was somehow traumatic and wrong. And the experience of my father, and indeed my aunt, was that adoption could be a very happy outcome. So I think that before taking as read the experience, in particular some of the American children who were adopted, we should bear in mind that adoption could work out very well, even when the circumstances of the family were straight.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Did you know that President Joe Biden actually suffers with a stammer? Earlier on in the week, I chatted to Jonathan Linklater of the Irish Stammering Association, where he talked a little bit about the impact that this has had on people like him who also suffer with the stammer. Jonathan started off telling me a little bit about his story.
Yeah, so I'm a person who's stutters, and I'm also a speech language therapist working for the Irish Stammering Association. I would have stuttered a lot as a child. It started around like my early years, so around 3 or 4 years old. I was having difficulty getting words out, and it was kind of there for my childhood. It didn't stop me getting involved and having friends and taking part in school, but it was definitely there, and had an impact on me, just being careful about how I spoke or what I was trying to say. And I struggled a lot and tried to, like, it took me a long time to get words out. And that would have been with me through secondary school as well. So kind of, you're always thinking ahead and thinking, can I say this word or can I answer this question in class? So it definitely had a kind of a knock-on in a daily situation. And gradually I started working on my speech a bit more. I went to speech therapy as a child. It didn't solve the problem, but we'll come to that as the interview goes on. It didn't go away as such. But when I became older, when I was 19, 20, I started working on it more, and I think I was more able to do that. I qualified as a speech therapist in my 20s, and then in the last 10, 15 years, I've been working as a speech language therapist, and my stuttering's changed again. So the more I've become more open about it, the more I've cared less about it, if that makes sense, it started to change, which is tying into what the Biden.
Yeah, and you haven't let it kind of define who you are, and it's motivated you, by the sounds of Jonathan, to keep working on it, and the fact that it's now part of your career, you know, helping others.
And that defining thing, I think that's what I've sort of watched some of Joe Biden's interviews and speeches of late, and he talks about not letting it define you, not letting it limit you. And I think those things are really important messages for people, as you said in your introduction. Like, I think overcoming it means different things to different people, but whatever it means, it shouldn't stop you doing the things you're doing. And I never intended to be a speech and language therapist. If you'd said that to me as a child, that would have been like, how on earth could that happen? But that's the route that it's ended up becoming. I've kind of grown into that, and obviously the more I've grown into that, the more my stuttering's changed as well. So I don't stutter as much as I used to. I still definitely stutter, as you can hear, but it doesn't stop me from doing things.
And that's probably encouraging so many people who might be listening, Jonathan, who might have their own speech impediments. And even I would imagine if you told yourself as well as a child that you'd be doing a radio interview, you probably wouldn't have believed it either.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sort of strange, that's what I talk to people. So I work as a speech language therapist as well, and I talk to them and say, like, because they often can't say certain things or don't feel like in certain things, and it's like, you don't know where the goals are going to be, so you can end up achieving things that you didn't expect to achieve. And that may be small things for some people, it may be bigger things for other people. It's different things. People might just want to read a story to the children, and that's a really significant thing. Or they may want to talk to the children's teacher, and those are really, really important things. So it's kind of, it's letting people know that whatever is the important thing to you, that's the thing you need.
Yeah,
to
the goals are unique to individuals, as you say.
Exactly.
And what about just, I'm sure you've worked with so many people, Jonathan, in your professional life, but do stutters and stammers vary in terms of just their how difficult they can be for some people, and I guess in the length of time it might take people to try and improve in that way?
Yeah, exactly. So like stuttering and stammering, it's the same thing. It's just that Ireland and the UK would say stammering more, but the rest of the world would say stuttering. So just in case people are wondering about that it's the same thing. We sometimes would talk about stuttering being a bit like an iceberg, in the fact you can see and hear part of it. You can hear these repetitions happening. You can sometimes see people struggling on things, but underneath the surface, there can be a lot of avoidance of words, thinking I can't say that word, or I get nervous in that situation, I'm going to struggle in that. So the underneath of the iceberg can be quite a big area the older people get, and the more negative experiences they may go through, or the more difficulty they have in situations. So some of what we do in therapy, and with even just talking with people in the support groups of the Stammering Association, is trying to get that iceberg raised up and talking about it and saying that it's okay. And if you can do that, then that iceberg starts to melt. So I think everyone's iceberg is quite different. There's certain things people find difficult, like people would often find things about themselves hard to say, like their own name. That can be difficult because they've struggled on that a lot. Or often saying something important to someone important can be a challenge. So
yeah, it's different challenges for different people. And as you say, Jonathan, people have different goals depending on, you know, their individual situations. How does it feel, and what sort of an impact does it have seeing someone as high profile as the President of America saying, hey, I struggled with this issue?
It's really important. I think it kind of normalises it. And I think that's one of the really important things we try and do with the Stammering Association is have our groups where people can meet other people, because I think there's a definite sense of isolation if you think you're the only person who has this and is experiencing this, thinking about this, that can be really challenging. So having the President of the United States, who has had over 80 million people vote for him, that some of them will know that he stutters, some of them won't, but it's a real validation that no one really cares about it. Like, obviously people care about it in a positive way, but they voted for him thinking that this man is capable.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
This week, the new Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Farrell, was installed. Earlier on in the week, I chatted to the editor of the Irish Catholic, Michael Kelly, to tell us a little bit about the challenges and opportunities that Dermot Farrell faces. And he started off just telling me a little bit about who he is.
Well, he is 66 years of age, so at a time when most people would be retiring or certainly thinking about retiring, he's taking on one of the most daunting challenges in the Church in Ireland. Up to this point, he's been the Bishop of Ossory. That's around Kilkenny, and he implemented very quickly a plan there that saw the rationalisation of a lot of parishes. There was, you know, duplication, and perhaps, you know, in the city of Kilkenny, you had maybe four churches having Mass at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and then maybe no Mass again until 12. So he fixed some of those things. And before that, he was a priest of the Meath Diocese, who had served as president of St. Patrick's College, Maynooth. That's the National Seminary and the Pontifical University there. So he's somebody who has a lot of background in administration. He has a lot of energy, and certainly my experience of it, when he puts his mind to a task, he's pretty single-minded about it. But I would say crucially as well, Wendy, he is somebody who has shown in the various roles that he's been in that he has an ability to unite people around a vision. I mean, this is not a man who's going to come into Dublin and announce that he has all the answers. This is an archbishop who's going to want to listen to people. He's going to want to hear from people on the ground. I mean, I would thought it was quite important when he spoke in the pro-cathedral on Tuesday morning. It was a very, very strange occasion, because normally something like that is the most important day in the history of the diocese. This isn't something that happens very often. You're talking about the replacement of an Archbishop of Dublin maybe five or six times a century. So it's not something that happens very often. But he spoke there where he said, I'm coming here, I don't know many of you, so I'm going to be looking forward to getting to know you and getting to hear what you think are the challenges, but also the opportunities. And I think the opportunities thing is key, because sometimes we're far too gloomy about things in the church, and we're very, very good at announcing everything that's wrong and all the problems. But then when we're asked to come up with the solutions, So he did an interview with me last week in the Irish Catholic, and that was one of the points he said. He said to me, I will listen to everybody with all their complaints, with everything that they're going to come to tell me that's wrong. But I'm going to say, okay, thanks. How do we fix this?
Yeah,
together?
What's your solution? And don't just kind of finger point, say, what are we going to do about it? Because he has kind of emphasised that. And it's something that I think we are recognising a lot as a church, that this is about a collaboration of the church between lay people, clergy, you know, working together and recognising this isn't just about kind of those who are on the collar doing the work.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would say in many ways, you know, people of a Protestant tradition would be much more familiar with this congregationalist idea of everybody working together. That's something perhaps that we haven't traditionally been very good at in the Catholic Church because, you know, the nature of our church, it's hierarchical, and that's a good thing, and it served the church well. But it has also contributed to a sense whereby sometimes people sit back and they say, oh, Father will do this or the Bishop will do this, so they'll provide the leadership and they'll provide the vision. And the Archbishop is saying, no, we all need to be part of this journey together. You know, if the church matters to us, if the faith matters to us, then this is something that we all have to come together and say, here's why this is important. And I think the one thing he will be saying to people is, the structures are there, the structures are important, whatever amalgamation or rationalization, call it what you like, whatever has to happen, the most important thing for him as an Archbishop of Dublin is to create a culture where people understand that the church exists to promote relationship with Christ, that that's ultimately what it's about. And you trim back whatever structures are necessary to ensure that that's the job. If I could put it in a kind of Harvard Business School sort of speak, I think the church needs to be fit for mission. And I think that's what he's going to be doing. That's what he's going to be pushing in Dublin, to try to revitalize things a little bit, because it's easy to sit and look at all the challenges. And COVID-19 has brought another whole range of challenges to faith communities in the country. And it's easy in that sense to become overwhelmed with that. And I think that's the opposite of the gospel. It's the opposite of what Christ is saying to us. So I think he's going to try to give people a bit of a boost around that. Not that he is, and he says this in his opening homily as well, not that he is naive about the future, not that he is naive about the challenges that he's facing, but putting his trust in God, he's hopeful that we can meet the challenges.
And one of the challenges, Michael, that he talked about was the decline in vocations and just the number of priests also that are elderly, and how are we going to face those challenges. But like you mentioned, that's a challenge, but where's the opportunity and where's the what can we do about it?
I mean, I think one of the things that we have to do in terms of the vocations crisis that, you know, frankly, we've been talking about for most of my adult life, is we need to build strong faith communities, because priests or religious sisters are not dropped down from heaven. I mean, vocations come from communities. Vocations come from Catholic families. And if they're not strong, if they're not being supported, then you're not going to have the vocations flourishing either. So if you go to a church and you look down and there's no one under the age of 40 in that church, then you can't shrug your shoulders and say, gosh, I wonder why there are no vocations, because the kind of people who vocations are coming from, they're not there in the congregation. So it's getting those people to connect. So I think what the Archbishop is going to have to do is chart a vision whereby the church is out in the public square, the church is out there promoting its message, an often controversial message. You know, let's be clear, in his interview with the Irish Catholic, he made it very, very clear that the current proposals before the Dáil in terms of assisted dying, that these are an assault on all people, because it's creating a culture that says that some lives don't matter. So it's not about watering down the gospel or trying to make the gospel more palatable to contemporary society, but it's about saying to young people, look, here contained in this message is a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge and an opportunity for you to take on, to live a better life, to make the world a better place. So I think that's the prospect that he's going to be setting before people.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
There's a virus that's going around that's causing some dogs to get sick, but the way it's been reported, you might think that it's something new, but actually it's not. So how can you identify it, and what's the best way to look after dogs who might get this virus? Well, earlier on in the week, I was joined by Pete the Vet, where he gave us some advice on this, but he started off just explaining exactly what the virus is.
Well, it's nothing to do with COVID, and we see this all the time, every year, and there seems to be often a little bit of a winter spike in this problem. Basically, the truth is it's a little bit of a mystery, because what the dogs show is quite severe gastroenteritis. And we know that there are many possible causes of gastroenteritis in dogs. And that includes scavenging, and dogs are really good at scavenging, just picking up bits and pieces when they're out and about. It includes allergic reactions. It includes, bacterial infections, as well as some viral infections. But from what we've heard, it seems most likely that this is a particular virus, and it's got a very unfortunate background in one sense, in that it happens to be a coronavirus, but it's what's called an enteric coronavirus, a canine enteric coronavirus. That means it's a virus that's in the coronavirus group, but it only affects the digestive tract of dogs, and they're quite well able to do with it. So many, many dogs show no signs of a problem at all, and they reckon that probably this is a cause of something like up to 20% of all cases of diarrhea in dogs. So it's a virus that's around a lot every year. It's been around for dozens of years, and there's nothing new about it. And most dogs are well able to cope with it.
And is it just dogs that can get it, Pete, or what about other animals?
Absolutely, just dogs. And affected animals typically have got vomiting and dullness, and they go off their food and have a bit of diarrhoea. And they don't have a fever, and that's really what most people see in their pets when their pets are affected.
And so in terms of, obviously, when it's gastro and a dog might be getting sick and all that sort of stuff, do we have to keep the dog at home? What about taking them out for walks, or how do you best care for them?
Well, I think any dog that's sick should really be kept at home, a bit like ourselves. If we've got any signs of unwellness, we should really stay at home as well. And look, many dogs have got minor signs, like maybe a couple of vomits, a little bit of diarrhea, maybe they don't eat their dinner one night. And as long as they stay bright and active, and as long as there's no other signs, then you can just basically fast them for 12 hours and then give them a bland diet, like cooked chicken and boiled white rice. But unfortunately, there are some dogs that get much more severe, and these are the ones that have been reported about in the media. And these dogs have, much more severe repeated vomiting, and sometimes they get the diarrhea gets bloodiness as well. Or they might become extremely dull and dejected, so they don't want to walk around at all. And those animals, they really do need to be taken to vet fairly urgently, because they probably need to be put onto an intravenous drip, and they need all that sort of extra support, like medication to stop the vomiting and all that sort of stuff, because it is potentially dangerous for those severe cases. But I don't think people should be worrying unduly, because even the dogs with the more serious signs do recover, usually within 2 to 3 days. So this is not like parvovirus, which is a virus that actually kills dogs very commonly. This is not the same as parvovirus. Coronavirus is a relatively benign virus.
Okay, so really it's obviously you'll know if your dog hopefully needs to go to a vet with the symptoms that you need to look out for. But do we know how dogs pick it up? Is it just one of those things? And obviously when it comes to animals, it's you can't really tell them to socially distance.
No. Basically, dogs, if a dog's infected, they'll pass the virus in their poos. Doesn't live for that long in the environment. Again, parvovirus is a virus that lives for many months in the environment, so it's much more infectious. This one doesn't live for that long, but if your dog is going to a public park where there's lots of other dogs and it has a sniff at where another dog has just done something, well, then it could well pick it up. But look, I need to stress, this is going on. We see this all the time. There's nothing new about this. And people shouldn't worry unduly. It's very hard in built-up areas to avoid going where there are other dogs, So it's something which I think people just need to as long as their dog is bright and eating and behaving normally, don't worry. And if your dog does get these signs, just be aware that it could be this condition. And I would say that there's a lot of, a little bit of hysteria around at the moment about this. And I'm hearing lots of comments in social media, especially about people who are panicking a bit. So what I've done is I've actually written a really good basic guide to the details of what all this is. And you can go and read that for yourself on my new website, which is petfixclub.com. At petfixclub.com, you can read the article, and that will tell you precisely the full truth about this viral gastroenteritis outbreak.
Great stuff, Pete, and I think it will give people all the information that they need. But it's probably also, just as we're talking about it and how dogs get it, it's probably a good time to remind people that they need to pick up after their dogs as well.
Well, indeed, it's another reason why it is sensible to pick up after your dogs, because if there is anything infectious in your dog's poo, well, it's best removed from the environment immediately. And so, yeah, pick up after them. It should be a basic habit at this stage.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.